This is Uncle Don, the Direst of Circumstances, coming to you on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. This is the 324th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo, being broadcast from the campus of Canada's Green University, where every light in the bloody joint is on and there's nobody here. Finally, Stephen Harper has paved the way to Canadian fiscal recovery by signing a free trade deal with Panama. Now we have this Central American powerhouse as an economic ally. I have a warm spot in my heart for Panama, having lived, worked, and played in their country. My family has a history there. When my grandfather wooed my grandmother, he went to her father for permission to marry. The man wisely asked how much money my grandfather had. Not much. Come back when you have $1,000 and you can have her hand. Back in those days, around the turn of the last century, a grand was serious money, not easy to come by. One place to make big bucks then was in Panama, working on constructing the canal. Down he went, getting work running a steam shovel and saving his pay. One day he reached the $1,000 goal and wired the news to my great-grandfather. Granny was on the next ship south. My father was born in the Panama Canal Zone 98 years ago, bearing dual citizenship until age 21 when he had to choose one. He selected American nationality. Good choice. When he graduated from university as an engineer, the Depression was in full swing and jobs were few, except with the Panama Canal Company, so down he and my mother went to live there until World War II was on the horizon, and they returned to the States to bring me into the world. During that war, my father served in the U.S. Navy as the commander of an LMD, as he described it. That was a large mahogany desk. He maintained a residual affection for the Navy, which manifested itself during the annual Army-Navy football games. Therefore, he was somewhat choked when I returned home from a dismal semester in college to announce that I was joining the Army. He launched into arguments as to why this was a bad idea, stopping only when I told him that I had already signed the papers. His parting shot at me when I left for basic training was, "You'll be in Leavenworth in 6 months." Leavenworth is the Army's notorious prison for recalcitrants. Defying his prediction, after basic training and schooling as an ordnance supply specialist, I was on a ship headed for Panama. Why Panama? Perhaps it was because, when asked where I wanted to be stationed, I requested Greenland or Germany as I hated hot weather. The U.S. Army always had a twisted sense of humor. I spent the next 30-some months living in concrete barracks with only screens on the windows due to the constant heat. While there, I developed an affection for Balboa beer and had more than a passing acquaintance with Panama Red, the local grass imported from the San Blas Islands, where it was the main economic support for the independent islanders. 50 years ago, Panama was in the earliest stages of economic development. There was agriculture for local consumption, cement, Balboa beer, that Panama Red, and international banking thriving in a legal tax haven. Of course, spin-off from the canal was a big boost, as well as civilian employment with the U.S. Army. I spent most of my days working with Panamanian civilians and found them generally good folks. When I was there, the national population was about 1 million. Now Panama City alone has more than that, and the entire country has 3.5 million, so things have changed drastically. The U.S. has turned the canal company over to the Panamanian government, and running that is the largest enterprise aside from agricultural processing. They also have some oil refinery, chemicals, and paper making. When I saw the photo of Harper and the president of Panama waving to the publicist photographer, I wondered what effect free trade between our countries will have. What will we buy from our new partner? Bananas? Balboa beer? Panama Red dope? Or maybe free trade will ease the way for the banks to continue money laundering and tax evasion for Canada's rich. Or perhaps, just perhaps, this whole free trade with Panama thing is just a charade, serving Harper as an opportunity to show how he is working to improve our export economy while giving Panama's president a chance to demonstrate that he can play in the big boys' sandbox. Why do Canadians care what happens in Texas as long as that state is willing to tolerate and isolate George Wanker Bush? We should pay attention as decisions made in the Lone Star State affect our children's education. That state's Board of Education is considering whether their educational standards should include teaching, quote, strengths and weaknesses of scientific knowledge. no apparent harm or benefit there. Why not encourage discussion of validity of scientific theories? Because this is a key phrase inserted by creationists to mandate the questioning of the facts of evolution. Yes, Virginia, there are still mobs of young Earth creationists running loose in Texas, including the chairman of the State Board of Education. I couldn't care less what the young of Texas believe or are taught, but mandated criticism of evolution is not confined to that one state. The American National Center for Science Education found seven other states which had entertained or were entertaining bills promoting religious creationism in their public schools. Creationism these days hides behind the euphemism intelligent design, a term coined to avoid American prohibition of mixing church and state. The cover was lifted by a federal judge in Pennsylvania who ruled intelligent design teaching unconstitutional, as it cannot uncouple itself from its creationist and thus religious antecedents. Amen. Canadians should care because the public schools of Texas, Alabama, Oklahoma, Iowa, New Mexico, and Louisiana buy a lot of science textbooks, more than all Canadian provinces. Some years ago, the last Canadian textbook printer was bought out by Americans, so we're at the mercy of what they put on the market in English. These foreign companies will avoid offending the troglodytes of backward states, so we can expect them to soft-pedal evolution in science books, passing it off as just a theory, allowing superstitious teachers to infect young minds with that young Earth creationism. It would be amusing, if not distressing, to think of a teacher of a class in geology trying to peddle the line that the universe is no more than 10,000 years old. But it could happen here. Stephen Harper declared that he will not increase taxes even after fiscal recovery, should that ever happen. This vaunted economist says we can easily return to surplus budgets within 5 years as the economy picks up. No sweat. There is indeed a free lunch, according to our Prime Minister. True conservatives agonize as their chosen leader blithely leads Canada ever deeper into debt, contrary to pure conservative doctrine. Recall that this crew was going to balance budgets, no matter what. Well, what happened, and even our eminent economist Prime Minister did not predict a fiscal collapse. He told a subsequent group of eight nation summit, "We will allow the deficit to persist if necessary. We will not, in order to meet some timetable, start raising taxes and cutting programs." Perhaps the operative word in his statement is "and." Conservatives, should we still be cursed with their leadership some years hence, will not, quote, "start raising taxes and cutting programs." I have no doubt that continuing deficits will be used as an excuse for nibbling away further at costs of our social safety net, including particularly more privatization of Medicare. If the Parliamentary Budget Officer and others are correct, we will not, even under the most optimistic conditions, eliminate deficits for 10 years in the absence of higher taxes. We're caught in a trap laid for us by proponents of globalization. As long as capital is internationally mobile and labor is trapped within national boundaries, there's pressure in every nation to reduce corporate costs through reduced taxes, more subsidies, overt and hidden, and repression of wages. If Canada bucked this trend by raising business taxes to rescue our federal budget, there would be incentive for ever more industries to move offshore where costs are lower and labor properly tamed by draconian governments. A way out of this trap would be the restoration of the dreaded protectionism. Tariffs could be applied to goods and services produced overseas under what we determine to be conditions of unfair advantage. For instance, a T-shirt manufactured in Haiti by workers paid pennies an hour in a sweatshop, a running shoe produced in Cambodia in similar conditions, would have enough tax added to its price so as to be competitive with similar products in Canada. Initially, this would hurt third world workers, but their employers could reduce or eliminate tariffs by increasing wages and improving working conditions for their workers, eventually helping companies, employees, and their country. Such barriers to free trade would horrify doctrinaire right-wingers and their corporate sponsors now running overseas sweatshops, but they would help us restore industries within our borders, ones selling to our own people and paying taxes which, when added to tariff income, would speed us back to budget surpluses. However much sense such changes might make in the long run, there's no chance that either major party in Canada would dare to offend their corporate sponsors and donors by stepping on their toes. Corporations want to continue producing offshore so they can make huge markups on imports while avoiding the payment of taxes to the home country that supports them so generously. If you have enough money, you can play the so-called justice system like an endless game. Look at Karl-Heinz Schreiber. He fended off extradition to Germany for 10 years. Brian Mulroney probably never will be called to account for taking bribes while prime minister. Conrad Black, meanwhile, continues launching appeals from his accommodations in Florida's Club Fed. If you're in government, you have unlimited funds to deter or defeat justice. I'm thinking here of the ploys Harper used to delay the return of Abdelrazzak to Canada. He continues to avoid allowing the homecoming of Omar Khadr, even in the face of two court decisions demanding that Americans release him from Guantanamo for return to Canada. It appears that our dear leader will launch yet another taxpayer-funded appeal to postpone the inevitable repatriation of this youth. Is there more to Harper's abandonment of troubled citizens overseas than meets the eye? Any Canadian must consider the fact that Canada's consulates are under no legal obligation to aid one of us in trouble. They and the Foreign Service have absolute discretion as to who to help and who to abandon to the vagaries of fate. I can tell you one thing. A businessman or woman with connections to conservatives will garner unlimited support in any foreign tussle. But an immigrant or refugee from a country not in current favor may find, like Khadr or Abdelrazzak, that they are either on their own or deliberately sabotaged. As an outspoken immigrant, I hesitate to travel anywhere outside of a sphere of progressive countries. It's a damned shame when you cannot count on the value of your passport. Gordon Campbell stirred up a hornet's nest with his sudden announcement that British Columbians will soon be saddled with a harmonized sales tax. He stands before us, lying through his teeth, by claiming that this was not secretly in the works before May's election. Decisions like this are not made precipitously. British Columbians are angry that, without popular consent, we're losing many provincial sales tax exemptions. We'll be hit with an added 7% on such as restaurant meals, haircuts, school supplies, and phone bills. To add insult to injury, Colin Hanson, Liberal finance minister, rejected public outrage by saying, quote, "You cannot design a tax system based on a popularity contest." Oh, can't you? My understanding of democracy is that it is essentially a system of governments which is a popularity contest. Representatives are chosen by the people to handle the day-to-day affairs of state, but important decisions are debated in legislatures with input from citizens. This added tax was declared with no debate in the legislature, nor any input from affected citizens. It's the work of a dictatorial government in contempt of democratic ideals. I have a humble suggestion for my provincial government. Go ahead and harmonize the tax as your mentor Stephen Harper demands. Take his billion-dollar bribe, on the condition that existing provincial tax exemptions will not be eliminated. Instead, those exemptions will be extended to the federal portion, thus providing a stimulus to the economy by reducing prices of restaurant meals and such by 5%. Why not? The British Columbia government jumped into the gambling business behind promises that profits would fund community arts, recreation, and sports. In a way, this was a good idea insofar as it diverted money from illicit gambling run by the mafia and bookies. Suckers will be suckers, whether their bets are legal or illegal. Gradually, our government has grabbed ever larger shares of this billion-dollar business to offset the taxes on the rich, who do not, as far as I know, provide a big market for lotteries and bingos. No, the people I see buying tickets at the grocery store and gas station are the poor sods who don't understand the odds while blowing their kids' milk money on dreams. Last year, the BC government turned over $156 million of its billion in revenue to some 6,800 community groups in BC. That, for you non-math majors, is less than 16% of the take. This year, dependent organizations are crying foul. Many were given a funding commitment upon which Campbell's bean counters have reneged. Based on promised revenue, the organizations borrowed for activities like the Vancouver International Children's Festival. They're now left holding the bag. It's sometimes difficult to grasp the duplicity and dirty dealing of this government. At least the Italian government lottery is honest in revealing that half of their sales go straight into the treasury, and winners get 38%. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. The BC Lottery Corporation has joined the private initiative to milk suckers at home through the internet. No longer must the gullible join the queues at casinos or lottery kiosks to lose their money. Ah, progress. Formerly, customers were restricted from blowing more than $125 a week on so-called internet games. In search of ever more funds to ease tax burdens on their smarter supporters, the government raised the limit in allowed losses to $10,000 a week. Now a gambling addict can lose at home in a few weeks, instead of just dribbling its value away for years. And they call this gaming. Maybe betting on a skill contest like poker is a game, but plugging a slot machine or choosing a number is gambling. Gordon Campbell once announced that he intended British Columbia to become the most literate jurisdiction in North America. Our local freebie paper tells me that, in pursuit of this goal, his Liberal government is cutting library literacy programs, eliminating 16 regional jobs. This at a time when Arthur Williams, publisher of the Free Press, claims that 2 out of 5 British Columbians have trouble reading his newspaper. Leaders of a civilized society would worry about such poor literacy, doing its best to improve such an embarrassing statistic. I'll let the implications of that one rest. I assume the Campbell government isn't concerned over whether 40% of us can read, only how we vote or don't. A more literate body of citizens might be inclined to look behind Liberal campaign propaganda when casting a ballot and vote on issues. Choices could be based on reason and information rather than emotional attack advertising on the tube. The public education system is a functioning democracy should have a primary goal of producing responsible citizens, willing and able to participate in the governing of their society. Training for jobs is important, but of secondary value. Taking that 40% functional illiteracy figure at face value, who are the 1.5 million British Columbians who cannot grasp the elementary English of a family newspaper? Some may be immigrants for whom English is a second language. Some have intelligence too low or mental dysfunctions prohibiting them from learning. Forgetting my rash assumptions derived from observing our drivers and shoppers, it's still difficult to believe that 4 out of 10 of us are incapable of acquiring reading skills. I have to conclude that the root of the problem lies in our education system. Either illiterates avoid public education, or we're streamed through school without learning. Why are malls crawling with school-aged children on a weekday? Once upon a time, there were public servants called truant officers whose job was apprehending children skipping school. Why can a kid receive a high school diploma which he or she can't even read? It looks like pupils are pushed from one grade to another just to keep them moving, whether or not they demonstrate mastery of the curriculum. We're breeding hundreds of thousands of youth trained for work of the last century, early last century. The old entry-level jobs are gone. No longer can one begin pushing a broom and work up the corporate executive. The broom pushers, the green chain, and the drillers in mines are gone. The unskilled jobs left out there, pay minimum wage and have no future. I suspect this is of no concern to our political masters. The underclass has been abandoned. As long as they can be controlled, kept from annoying the well-to-do, they will be ignored. They're fodder for police, jails, and minimal social service agencies. Keep them down, fixated on television soap operas, and informed by advertising. They'll always provide soldiers for foreign missions and fillers for spots in Mall Ward and McDonald's. They'll guard the gated communities for the rich and clean their swimming pools while their betters rule the country and glean the fruits of our economy. As a young child, I was fascinated by my grandmother's collection of old National Geographic magazines. What I recall best were photographs of Africans with various body modification practices. Ubangi women inserted plates in their lips, while others put brass rings around their necks, forcing down collarbones and giving the appearance of long necks. Some stretched earlobes with heavy weights. Such modifications were to enhance beauty in the eyes of potential partners. Some modifications, like female genital mutilation, are over the edge for our society, but many others have become popular. Ours can be as weird as those of African tribes. What could be stranger than injecting toxins under the skin to modify wrinkles, or forcing junk into lips, giving them an unnatural pouting look? I won't go into temporary cosmetic changes like smearing soot around the eyes or odd dyes to the lips, nor will I look at perfumes, such as the expensive commercial smells Cadillac and Hummer, supposedly for men. Just what I would want to smell like an SUV with just a hint of diesel. My first experience with tattoos was in the U.S. Army. Some fellow soldier sported these dubious artworks as a result of over-drinking. Every so often, usually on a Sunday morning, someone in the barracks awoke with a ripping hangover and a sore body part, sporting a newly inked tattoo. The favorite was a panther clawing its way shoulderward, leaving red claw marks. Very cute, and I suppose those fading artworks on sagging biceps are now humorous. Half a century ago, tattoos were applied by sinister-looking men in sleazy back-alley shops. Their customers were drunken soldiers and sailors, gang members, and sordid criminal types. As for me, I always passed out before becoming drunk enough to want to acquire permanent pigments under my skin. In the 21st century, I'm out of step with my culture. I think tattoos are ugly, an atavistic reversion to the body mutilation of primitive times and societies. From the cute little flower on the ankle to the full-body reproduction of the Sistine Chapel's ceiling, all are but a few steps removed from Congolese lip plates. If my opinion offends you, suck it up. It's mine, and you needn't share it. Canadians are often excoriated by economists as our productivity lags behind that of Americans. The implication is that we are plagued with feather bedding and lazy workers slacking on the job. The reality of this raw statistic is somewhat more stark. What this productivity actually measures is labor productivity, or the economy's total dollar value divided by the number of labor hours required for output. American productivity is taking a large jump, a fact that they're supposed to celebrate and we should emulate. I expect that we will, as usual, follow the American example. But look at how this upsurge has been achieved. The U.S. economy contracted, but total number of hours worked decreased faster. Each hour worked by remaining employees has produced more output, but at what a cost? Workers are stressed by having to accomplish work formerly done in less time or by others even while they fear for their own jobs. These stresses manifest themselves in family breakdown, alcoholism, and antisocial reactions. Much of the rebound in corporate stocks is based not on increased sales or services, but on greater profitability squeezed from employees. New standards of more for less are becoming entrenched, so those now employed will find work harder and less lucrative if they ever get back in jobs. Yes, companies are making more money, but that's not being translated into higher payrolls, payrolls relied upon to spur recovery of consumer spending. Economic health is not like dieting. We cannot shrink our way to success. I wonder why many atheists feel compelled to use euphemisms to identify themselves as rational. One commonly adopted label is humanist. Living as an atheist, literally without God, is certainly not something for which to be ashamed. When I lived in Victoria many years ago, I discovered the locally produced publication, The Humanist in Canada. I visited their office, buying all back issues available. In reading them, I discovered that defending rationality against superstition is boringly repetitive, while advocates of various old religions can snow believers with volumes of speculation based on their ancient books, splitting hairs and attempting to bring the unbelievable to respectability. We atheists have little to say except variations on the theme that we reject unsubstantiated claims of religions. We can flop about chasing and challenging incredible nonsense about a 10,000-year-old universe, forbidden apples, abundant miracles, ships full of animals, and books dictated by the holy, but it all boils down to defense of the proven against the incredible. Thanks to a listener friend, I have to hand a copy of the quarterly publication Humanist Perspectives out of Ottawa. I wasn't aware of this magazine, as our local library doesn't carry it. Maybe they can't afford the subscription with current budget constraints. Maybe they fear offending believers. Maybe they're aware that there are freaks in our community who enter school libraries to steal and destroy materials they find offensive to their irrational beliefs. The spring edition of Hume's Perspective strays from the narrow path of challenging silliness. One article was written by a former resident of Cologne, Germany, who witnessed the carpet bombing of that city. It was then that he rejected the idea of a loving God who could permit such massive human suffering as he saw. Another author challenges the Canadian government's use of our military to support an American war against Afghanistan while failing to protect our sovereignty when faced with incursions by our supposed ally. There's a piece on bus ads reading, "There probably is no God," springing up in cities across Canada in the storm of protest by fundamentalists who brook no opposition to their thought controls. An article examines papal history over the centuries and the evolution of their conflicting infallible declarations. But the outstanding piece examines the phenomenon of democracy, our interpretation of it, and what it means in practice. We've come to accept that democracy means elections every few years. This is a necessary but not sufficient condition for democracy. In application, it's meant that we have the freedom to select candidates for office from a slate approved by a minority controlling established political parties. We then suffer the rule of the chosen for a period of time before running to the polls to ratify their administration or replace the miscreants with a slate of similar miscreants. Between elections, we have an effective dictatorship unresponsive to either the will of citizens or the promises which got them elected. Our system creates the illusion that government is accountable to voters. In reality, it responds to the wants and needs of a corporate elite, best exemplified in Canada by the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Our mass media, either owned by corporations or, when public, accountable to them by virtue of a lickspittle government holding the purse strings, controls what we see, hear, and read. Critical books and periodicals, like Humanist Perspectives, are free to publish and criticize as long as their audiences are small and ineffective. Even community radio stations are allowed so long as few hear them over the din of commercial radio. Governments, whether conservatives, liberal, New Democrat, or bloc, love to operate in secrecy. Freedom of information laws are so riddled with loopholes and plagued with delays in implementation that their application is seldom more than symbolic. We cannot trace the maneuverings that led to the sale of British Columbia's railway. We are not able to penetrate the secrecy of our national police force, which polices itself. We'll not be allowed to determine how Gordon Campbell suddenly decided to lay increased sales taxes on us. We can count the bodies coming home from Afghanistan, but information about the mentally and physically disfigured are kept from our tender ears and eyes. But not all of this magazine was heavy pieces. There's also poetry and a sprinkling of quotations, including the following. Bertrand Russell wrote, "Religion is something left over from the infancy of our intelligence." Mark Twain said, "Faith is believing what you know ain't so." Plato must have had a window into the 21st century when he wrote, "Good people do not need laws to tell them to act responsibly, while bad people will find a way around the laws." I was impressed enough by this publication to buy a subscription. Check it out. This concludes the 324th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.